Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12 is where we are this evening. Yet again, picking up at verse 6, reading down to verse 8. And this is our penultimate study in this series. Romans chapter 6, reading down, chapter 12, sorry, reading from verse 6 down to verse 8. Says, having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministry, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation, he that giveth, let him do it with simplicity, he that ruleth with diligence. Shall we pray? Father, we thank thee tonight for your word. We thank you, O God, that we have had this opportunity to study the spiritual gifts and to assess our own standing in this area and to consider how you may have bestowed a gift upon us and which gift we may have been endowed with. And Father, we pray tonight as we look at this gift, the gift of administration, that Father, if there's someone here tonight who possesses this gift, that you would help them to see something of themselves reflected in the thoughts that are shared and in the scriptures that are presented, and Lord, to identify their gift with confidence and then put it to good use within this local fellowship. Now, Father, we commit all that we're about to say to thee. We ask for your help and guidance and leadership, and we pray that your word would be clear to us in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so we're coming now to the sixth in our series of spiritual gifts. And we're looking here at the gift of ruling, or as we shall call it, the gift of administration. And this gift in biblical terms suggests the exercise of governance. It carries with it the idea of management, of organization. In Romans 12, verse 8, that word ruleth there literally means he who is placed in front. He is who is placed in front. And the reference is to anyone in a position of superintendence within the local church, though not necessarily does it refer to someone holding an office. So although the pastor is often the one who's standing in the front, so to speak, there are times when it won't be the pastor, but it'll be somebody else in another area of ministry who's standing at the front. So though a pastor must learn to exercise administration as a discipline, as a skill, as a gift of his ministry, it is not necessarily his primary gift. That said, it could be your gift. Someone come in there. Oh. I see. Okay. So the one with the gift of administration has the capability of taking over something. You know, they could be charged, but the whole area of ministry, and they will take charge of it, and they will lead that particular ministry or that particular matter. They're the kind of person who you will rarely see in a flap. They never turn a drama into a crisis. The administrator has a good eye on or for organization and for order and for a methodology in approaching a particular problem or project. And so, you know, you can well see, I think, even from the outset, that this is quite an important gift in any church, because you do need people who can take charge of ministries or who can take charge of particular matters and can be entrusted with those things and will pull others into helping and use their gifts accordingly and see that the thing gets done. So let's consider the characteristics then of administration. And the first thing I want you to see about an administrator is that administrators are visionary. They have the ability to comprehend the big picture. They can see where a thing is going, or sometimes even not going, because they can realize that it is not properly organized if something has been done in a haphazard way. So they're very good at formulating tangible goals. They set objectives for themselves, and an appropriate action is set in order to meet those goals. And so they tend to have
a tunnel vision. When they are given a task and they're asked to do something, well, then they see only that goal at the end of that project, and at that moment in time, nothing else matters. They are focused, they're determined, and they are decisive, and they're going to get to the end of that project that they have been allocated with. Also, administrators are efficient. They show tremendous efficiency. Their motivation is to arrange things well and to properly delegate. So they will have a very methodical approach to any given assignment. They'll be able to order their thoughts aright. They'll be able to bring big projects and break them down into smaller tasks so as to set a project plan in order and successfully attain their goal. So let's say we decided to paint this entire building, decorate this entire building, which I think you would agree would be a big project. The administrator would see right off, well, first of all, we've got to do this. And then they would push some people in to do that. So they say, well, first of all, we've got to assess exactly what has to be done. What do we need? Where can we get this? How much is it going to cost? Who can do this? And then they start pulling those strands together and they break it down into little tasks. So they wouldn't say, well, you know, let's just paint all the ceilings. No, they'd probably say, well, let's start in the nursery and we'll paint the ceiling in the nursery and we'll decorate in there and then we'll work into this fellowship hall. And they have a method to what they're doing. Now, they take that approach not just in DIY, but they take that approach in anything that they're asked to do. Administrators are no-nonsense people. They don't suffer fools gladly. The expression is often, if you want something done, ask a busy person. You've heard that, haven't you? And that's what an administrator usually is. They're usually a busy person, but if you want something done, that's the person to ask, because they're very much on the ball. They're not going to waste time, and they definitely will just take a no-nonsense approach to any project that you give them. They're not going to waste their energy, waste motions, and speed of delivery is a priority with them. So if it's a little thing, they'll get to it, it'll be done and out of their hair. If it's a big thing, they'll stick at it until it is done, and nothing will distract them from that task. Administrators are resourceful. They have a natural awareness of the resources that are available to them and that may be needed for a project. They also have an idea who they might use in that project and what might be available to the task at hand. Most people, if we're honest, most people tend to underestimate how long a thing is going to take or the cost of a particular thing. Perhaps a good example of that would be our building project. We started down that road. Some folks thought we should have that thing up in 6 weeks and we should all be moved in. And they didn't realize that there was all of this paperwork and all of this preparatory bureaucracy and whatever to go through in order to get to the end goal. So, that, an administrator would have saw right off that this was going to be a long-term thing. They would have had a fair idea of the costing involved and how that was going to be financed and so on. They take things into account with reasonable accuracy. Now, they may not know every penny that's going to be spent, or of course they may not foresee a particular hiccup down the road, but generally they have a fairly accurate idea of how long a thing is going to take, how much it's going to cost, who's going to be needed on it, and so on, and they can tell right off whether a particular project is viable or not. Administrators also are tremendous delegators. They know how to pass on responsibility. Okay, so they don't do everything for everybody all of the time. They have this orientation where they tend to delegate well and wisely. So they can, for example, look around the congregation. They could tell what somebody is capable of, and they would go to that person and they would, try to encourage them to get involved in a particular project and to use their capabilities in that way. They'll grant responsibility according to a person's capabilities. So, if you're good with your hands, if you're the kind of person who's hands-on, an administrator will recognize that. And if there's a hands-on type job, they're going to come looking for you. If you're good with paperwork, you're good in office work, well then, if there's that kind of a project at hand, then they'll come looking for you, and so on. They tend generally to remove themselves from the actual work that's being done, because he's kind of, he always worry me, Shirley. He smiles at me. Okay, stop. So you can smile all you want. They tend to remove themselves from the work that has to be done, you know, as far as their own personal engagement with it. And they do that because they don't want to be distracted from the bigger picture. They want to see how the whole thing is fitting together. And so they want to achieve the ultimate goal, and that's where their focus is. Administrators are durable. What do we mean by that? We mean that they're not easily put off. They can take criticism. They don't mind taking criticism because, you know, as far as they're concerned, that's not really important. What's important is getting to where they need to go. So you criticize them, and they hear it, but it's just, you know, water off a duck's back. Other people with down tools and go and cry, and, oh, I'm not doing it, somebody has spoken. But an administrator is just going to keep going and not worry about it. Now, in every church, there's two types of people, I've found. There's those people who say, well, let's do something new, let's do something different. And they get excited about new things and different things. And then there's another group of people who say, well, you know, we've always done it this way. And it's always worked in the past, and there's no reason to change it now. Now, anytime you try to do anything in church, those two groups will rear their heads, okay? You'll have one group, particularly if it's something new or different, that gets excited about that, and then the other group are like, oh, no, we ought not to upset the apple cart and do things different and rock the boat. Well, the administrator is very clever in this area because he knows or she knows when it's a good idea to change things, but he or she also knows when it's a good idea just to keep things as they are, and they see that something is working, and there's no point in changing it. That said, they will buckle themselves for criticism from either one of those camps. You know, if the new folks, the ones that like the new things, criticize them for being stuck in the mud and not changing things, that's fine. The administrator will just stay on that well-worn path that he thinks is going to work. If, on the other hand, he tries something new and different, and the more traditionalist-minded people say, well, we've always done it that way, and they throw that criticism at him, he's not going to be deflected from that either. He's going to just stay on his path, and he's going to take those criticisms on the chin. He'll also take opposition from without, as well as from within the church. So he's not going to bat an eyelid that somebody from another church criticized what they were doing, what you're doing, or another Christian somewhere criticized what you're doing. They're not really going to care about that because they're doing what they have to do and they're not really interested in those kinds of criticisms. Administrators seek loyalty. In order to function, and this is a peculiarity perhaps of this because it does generally tend to be a leadership type role. And because of that, administrators want to be sure that they have the confidence and support of those people who are involved in the project. And so they're very much lean toward loyalty. They expect loyalty from those they're serving, and they will be intensely loyal to those they are serving. And that's in their nature. But then also administrators are inspirational. By that I mean they generally inspire other people to do well, to do things that they never thought was possible. To bring out the best in themselves. So they encourage people in that regard, maybe to get involved in something that they didn't think was viable. And lo and behold, it was. And so they tend to praise a lot, encourage a lot, be cheerleading a lot. They tend to be signaling approval for people, challenging people. And if you feel like, you know, if he feels like you're doing a good job, well, the administrator is going to come along, he's going to tell you, you're doing a good job. Now, he's not going to be insincere about that. He's not flattering you. If he thinks you're doing a bad job, well, he'll push you aside and get somebody else in to do the job. But if he thinks you're doing a good job, he'll come alongside you and say, you're doing a good job. You know, stick at it. You know, I really appreciate what you're doing, and we're getting to where we want to go. So they sort of buck you up a little bit. Generally, they bring out the best in people. All right? So they have a joy, and we haven't put this on the overhead, but they have a joy in fulfillment of the project. So when the project's complete, they're excited about that. You know, they have a degree of personal satisfaction. So they step back and they say, wow, that was a great job. And they take a lot of satisfaction and rejoice in the work that has been done. Okay, so we want to think about a Bible character who exemplifies this particular gift. And the character I've chosen is not a New Testament character, but an Old Testament character. Any suggestions who this might be? Nope, not Solomon. Not Joseph. No, not Moses. Who? Aaron? No, not Aaron. Nehemiah is the character. Nehemiah. Now, the book of Nehemiah tells the story of the third wave of returnees from ancient Persia to Israel following the captivity. And following the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians, and the captivity of the Jews, the people returned first under the leadership of Zerubbabel, then under the leadership of Ezra, and now this third wave comes under the leadership of Nehemiah. Now, under Ezra, the first returnees, or the first, they rebuilt the temple. If you recall, the temple was laying in a state of disrepair. Haggai was around at that time. He was encouraging people to get on with the job and finish the job, and they did. They completed the temple, but the walls of the city were still laying in ruins, and that's where Nehemiah comes in, because Nehemiah, his goal as an administrator was to oversee the building of the city walls. Okay? Now, how does Nehemiah then exemplify these particular characteristics? Well, first of all, in rebuilding the city walls of Jerusalem, and understand the city wall was very important to ancient cities. It was a sign of its security and of its defenses and so on. So, and even to some degree of its well-being. So it was very important to the people that the walls should be rebuilt, but nobody to that point had actually made any effort to do it. But Nehemiah visualized the possibility of removing this great affliction and reproach of God's people by seeing to the rebuilding of Jerusalem's walls. So let's look in Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 2. And we'll see that here's Nehemiah receiving news that the walls are still, after almost a century, in a state of disrepair. It says that Hanani, one of my brethren, in verse 2 of chapter 1, came, he and certain men of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Now, as I said, these city walls have been in this condition. You know, it wasn't a recent thing. They had been in this state for the best part of a century. And yet, no one to that point had thought to themselves, you know what, we ought to fix this. We ought to get a team going and put this thing back together again. No one saw it. But Nehemiah saw that it could be done and that it should be done. And he set about organizing the project. Look in chapter 2 and verse 5. Here he comes on to the king, to Artaxerxes, and he said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. So he saw what could be done, all right? He didn't settle for the status quo as all the other folks had done. He was a visionary. He realized that there was a possibility here, that there was a viability, and he determined that he was going to engage himself in the building of that wall if the Lord should permit him and his employer, Artaxerxes, should indeed grant him permission to do so. Nehemiah also showed the administrator's typical efficiency by breaking down this major project into smaller, achievable tasks. Chapter 3 of Nehemiah, we're not going to take the time to read it, but it details how he organized the people into smaller groups, working on their own section of the wall. And in many ways, that's how churches work best. You know, churches work best when you have small parties, each taking care of their own particular area of ministry. And if you've got an administrator there who can oversee that, well, that's a great blessing. You know, if you have someone who can head up the Sunday school program, and somebody can head up the music program, and somebody can take care of youth work, and somebody can take care of the deacons and make sure that the physical aspects of church life are catered to, and so on. You know, and you can look at the various departments there. If a church to work well, you know, and for it to be well organized, it has to be broken down into smaller tasks and smaller groups of people, each serving in their own particular area and contributing to the good of the whole. The problem that often arises in churches is that you have the same people pretty much doing pretty much all the work. And that was never, it's never the right way. It's never the will of God. I don't believe that the same group of people should carry the can for the entire body of the local church. Everybody should be involved in some area of ministry. And not everybody has to be an administrator, obviously, but everybody should say, you know what, here's something I could give myself to, and here's a way in which I could serve, and be involved in that, and be faithful to that, and commit your gifts and talents to that, and hopefully there will be somebody in place who will have this ministry of ruling who can pull such folks together in that aspect and area of ministry and make it work for the good. Nehemiah, and you know, this is one of the things I like about Nehemiah, he did not suffer fools gladly. And I suppose in some ways I identify with him in this area. Look in Nehemiah chapter 13. He was a no-nonsense person. And, you know, I love this aspect of his character. In Nehemiah chapter 13 and in verse 23, it says, "In those days also saw I Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab. And their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod, and could not speak in the Jewish language, but according to the language of each people. And I contended with them, and cursed them, and smote certain of them, and plucked off their hair, and made them swear by God, say, you shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons or for yourselves." So he wasn't a guy who messed about, was he? He wasn't very gentle with them. He said, "Now look here, listen to me. Listen here, you know. Buck up your ideas here, you know. We're going to get this sorted out." And verse 26, he says, "Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations was there no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God and marrying strange wives?" And one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite. That's his arch enemy and the chief opponent of this project. Now look what he says. "Therefore I chased him from me." He says, "Get out of my sight." You know, now you bear in mind who he is. He's the son of the high priest. So he's a pretty, you know, influential figure. At least he's somebody whose father's pretty influential in that particular culture. In chapter 5, we'll see this in a moment, he tackles the nobles because they exact usury from the people. They demand mortgages from the people and put them in debt, and in so doing, distract them from the work. But I like this about Nehemiah. You know, and this is one of the things about an administrator. Administrators don't mind. They're not going to worry about losing people if those people are not committed to the common good. You know, and sometimes that happens. Sometimes you say, "Well, I'm not coming back." Well, you know what an administrator does? He says, "Well, good, close the door on your way out." And you say, "Well, that's very harsh." But that's the way he's thinking. He sees that person as not contributing to the good. And so he doesn't go running down the road. Now, next week we'll look at the merciful person. They'll be chasing down the road after that person. "Oh, please come back. We need you. You know, you're so important to us." And the administrator's going, "Good riddance of bad rubbish. Right, everybody, let's get on with it. Come on, you know, let's put it." And they're two opposite characters in many ways. So they're not going to worry about people who they see as standing in the way of progress. And it doesn't matter how wealthy they are. As we see in a moment or two, Nehemiah challenged the nobles. the wealthy people. He didn't mind getting in their faces. It doesn't matter how influential they are, whether they have family connections. He's going to deal with them. You know, sometimes in churches, and particularly in smaller churches, you have family units, you know, where people are all interconnected. So we have that in our church. We have several families and branches of families that are interconnected. Well, an administrator, he's not going to take that into account. You know, if he thinks that someone's not pulling their weight and that person says, well, I'm going to go and my family's going to go with me, he's going to say, well, we'll miss you. See you then. And he's going to carry on. Now the rest of the church members are pulling their hair. Go, what's he think he's doing? But he thinks he's getting on with his job is what he thinks he's doing. And he's not going to fret about that. He's not going to worry about that. He's not going to suffer fools or people who are obstinate and difficult in regards to the task at hand. Nehemiah knew what was needed for his project and what might be available to complete the task at hand. Look in chapter 2 of Nehemiah and verse 6. Now, he's the cupbearer to the king Artaxerxes. And he approaches this king and he asks permission to take a leave and to go to Jerusalem and help build these walls. And in verse 6, the king said unto him, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be? And when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given to me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come into Judah. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give the timber to make beams for the gates of the palace, which appertain to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Now notice what he does. He requests these various items, and he does it in a very orderly, methodical way. That was his approach. He gives a specific time. The king says, well, you know, you're one of my employees here. You're my cupbearer. How long are you going to be? He says, I set him a time. He says, I figured out how long this was going to take. And then he thought to himself, well, I'm going to be traveling through various provinces on the way there. I'm going to need a passport. So he says, if you give me a letter of recommendation that will convey me on, well, that'll make my journey a bit easier. I'll be able to cross borders and pass on to Jerusalem and get there sooner. And then he requisitioned timber. And he asked for timber for specific purposes in regards to the building of the wall. So in that regard, he was resourceful. Nehemiah also did not personally get involved in the building of the wall itself, but rather he removed obstacles that prevented others from building the wall and engaging in the work, such as financial pressures. Look in Nehemiah chapter 5 now, and I alluded to this earlier on. In Nehemiah chapter 5, the Jews complained because of their debt. And, you know, if you were in debt, and you're seriously in debt as they were, well, that's the thing that's at the foremost of your mind, at the forefront of your mind, isn't it? You know, how am I going to get out of debt? And that was their problem. In verse 1 it says, there was a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren the Jews. For there were that said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many, therefore we take up corn for them, that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses, that we might buy corn because of the dearth. There were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute. You know, it's an interesting thing. In our society, you cannot pay your tax bill with a credit card. You know that? You cannot pay it with a credit card. If you go online to pay a tax bill, they won't accept a credit card payment. And that's for this very reason. People were borrowing money to pay their tax debt. And the government discourages you from borrowing to pay a tax debt. But that's what they were doing here. They were having to raise mortgages and so forth to pay tribute.
and that upon our lands and vineyards. Verse 5, yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And though we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants, and some of our daughters are brought into bondage already, neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. So here their children, their young people, were being made slaves, effectively servants to these mortgagers, and to these who had them in debt, and they saw no way of getting their kids back and of paying the debt. And verse 6, he doesn't suffer fools gladly. And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. And then verse 7, I love this. Then I consulted with myself. I love that line. I just love it. It's like, who should I talk to about this that would be smart? Me. I'll talk to myself. So he consulted with himself. He had a little think about it. And then what did he choose to do? And I rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, ye exact usury every one of his brother. And I set a great assembly against them. He led this popular revolution, if you like. And he said unto them, we, after our ability, have redeemed our brethren, the Jews, which were sold unto the heathen. And will ye even sell your brethren, or shall they be sold unto us? He said, you know, it's bad enough. The Babylonians took us into slavery. Are you now, our own people, going to bring us into slavery? Then held they their peace and found nothing to answer. They realized their backs were against the wall. And also I said, it's not good that ye do. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? I likewise and my brethren and my servants might accept of them money and corn. I pray you, let us leave off this usury. Stop taking interest of people. Restore, I pray you, to them, even this day, their lands and their vineyards, their olive yards, their houses, also the hundredth part of the money and of the corn, the wine and the oil that ye exact of them. Now, Nehemiah was very keen that the work should not be hindered, nor indeed that the workers should not be distracted by this, what he considered an unnecessary and indeed an unlawful burden being placed upon them. He also withstood his critics very well, both within and without the project, in order to achieve his goal. Look in chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 7. It says, but it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. Nevertheless, we made our prayer unto God and set a watch against them day and night because of them. And Judah said, the strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed, and there is much rubbish, so that we are not able to build the wall. And our adversary said, they shall not know, neither see, till we come in the midst of them, and slay them, and cause the work to cease. And it came to pass that when the Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times, from all places whence ye shall return unto us, they shall be upon you. Therefore set I in the lower places behind the wall and on the higher places. I even set the people after their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people, be not ye afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. Now, this is a great speech, isn't it? I mean, it's almost Braveheart quality here, I think. You know, you almost see him standing there. You know, how dare they? They're going to attack us. You stand there. We're going to fight for our sons and our daughters and our land. And you got to see. And you know what he's saying? He's bringing out the best from them. Now, you know, from one minute, they're fighting over, oh, we're going to be attacked. We're going to be defeated. They're going to tear down the wall again. And you can almost see their shoulders starting to rise. And he's right. There's no way they're going to take this from us. And so it says, verse 15, it came to pass when our enemies heard that it was known unto us, and God had brought their counsel to naught. They hadn't discouraged them. That we returned all of us to the wall, every one unto his work. And it came to pass from that time forth that the half of my servants wrought in the work, and the other half of them held both the spears, the shields, and the bows, and the habergeons. And the rulers were behind all the house of Judah. They which built it on the wall, and they that bare burdens with those that laid it, every one with one of his hands wrought in the work, and with the other hand held a weapon. For the builders, every one of them had a sword girded by his side, and so builded, and he that sounded the trumpet was by me. And I said unto the nobles, and to the rulers, and to the rest of the people, the work is great and large, and we are separated upon the wall, one from far from another. In what place therefore ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort ye hither unto us, our God shall fight for us. So we labored in the work. And half of them held the spears from the rising of the morning till the stars appeared. Likewise, said at the same time, I unto the people, let every one with his servant lodge within Jerusalem, and in the night they may guard, be a guard to us, and labor on the day. So neither I, nor my brethren, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard which follow me, none of us put off our clothes, saving that every one put them off for washing. So he handled that particular problem. It was a criticism both within and without. Sanballat and his cronies said, we're going to attack you. The men of Judah said, look, people are down in twos. They're not prepared to fight. And he wasn't willing to take that. He wasn't willing to accept that as an answer. And he said, basically, he pulled them together and said, look, you know, it's a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. We'll defend ourselves and we're going to get this thing built. Okay? Look at chapter 6 and verse 1. Now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall, and there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief, and I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you? You see what he did? Here they were. Again, these were his critics. These were the ones that were opposing the work. And they said, hey, come on, you know, come on down to the valley here. Down into Ono. And we'll have some conversation. We'll dialogue about things. You know, we'll discuss what's going on. Of course, they had no intentions of discussing what they were looking to do them in, weren't they? It was an ambush. But, you know, He rose above it, and he says, you know what, this work's bigger than you. He said, I'm not going to waste my time talking to you. You know, I'm not going to go down there and spend, you know, hours and hours discussing anything. Forget it. I've got a big work to get on with here, and I'm going to get it. He just wouldn't allow himself to be detracted or distracted by criticism or by opposition. As an administrator, Nehemiah demanded loyalty from those he was serving. Let's go back to chapter 5 for a moment. In chapter 5, you know, where he was upset with those nobles and rulers for extracting money from the people at the cost of the building project, he views this as an act of disloyalty. He takes it almost personally. And consequently, he actually requires an oath of commitment from them. Having rebuked them, having brought all the people out to say, look, this isn't odd, you've got to stop taking interest of us, you've got to pay the people back, give them their houses back, give them their lands back. And then to underscore all of that, he makes them take an oath. Notice verse 11. He says, restore, I pray you, to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, their houses, also the 100th part of the money and of the corn, the wine and the oil that you exact of them. Then said they, we will restore them and will require nothing of them. So will we do as thou sayest. Then I called the priests and took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise. Also I shook my lap and said, so God shake out every man from his house and from his labor that performeth not this promise, even thus be he shaken out and emptied. And all the congregation said, amen, and praise the Lord. And the people did according to this promise. Now, you see what he did? I think it's brilliant. I think he's a brilliant leader.
Nehemiah. You know, you think if you were in that crowd, if you were one of those people that was paying a mortgage and you never could get to the bottom of it, you know, you could never pay it off, and maybe your sons and daughters were working to pay it off, and there's still no sign of the debt being cleared. And now Nehemiah comes in, he champions your cause. You know, and he brings everybody out into the street, he brings the nobles and the rulers out, and he rebukes them, and he says, this isn't on, you know, you've got to give them back their house and their land. And they said, all right, we'll charge them no more, we're not going to charge them. And he said, well, fair enough, but you've got to make a promise. And he demands they make this oath. And so they make the oath, and then he does this little sermon, you know, this little object lesson. He takes his lap and he shakes his garment. He says, and let that happen to anybody, you know. If you break this promise, let God take your possessions from you. And let him shake out you from your house and from your labor. And all the people, how do you think they felt, you know, when he's rebuking these elders this way? You know, you can almost see them. Their hearts are probably swollen, you know, with gladness that somebody was fighting their, that here he was fighting their cause. And it not only demanded loyalty from the rulers and the nobles, but I think it also stirred loyalty from the common people because they saw he was on their side. And they all shouted, Amen. And they were absolutely behind him, okay? Tremendous leadership on his part. All right, Nehemiah's oversight of this project inspired and encouraged the people so as to get the best from them. You know, Nehemiah was actually quite a cheery chap. Look in chapter 2 and verse 1. There's an indication here of his disposition in chapter 2 and verse 1. Bearing in mind now he's the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. Now, all this week I've been thinking about cupbearers because we're going to talk about the chief butler on Sunday morning, and he's the cupbearer to Pharaoh. And what does a cupbearer do exactly? He has this wonderful job that nobody would apply for in their right mind. He tastes the king's wine in the event that someone may have poisoned him. And if he drops over dead, he's done a wonderful job, and the king is very pleased with his service, gives him a very honorable funeral, and employs a new cupbearer. So this is his job. Now, I would imagine, you know, if you were going to work every day with the thought that you might be poisoned, it wouldn't exactly encourage you to get up in the morning, would it? You know, some mornings, you know, my wife says, I've got to do this tomorrow, and I can tell she's not looking forward to it, whatever it is that she's doing in her work. And, you know, we've all been there. We've all thought, oh, God, you know, do this or that tomorrow. And you're not looking forward to it. Well, imagine if she said, oh, I've got to go into work tomorrow and the boss is going to poison me. I'm not looking forward to it. Say, well, I understand that. That's pretty understandable. Well, look here. Verse 1, it says, it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that the wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before times sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of the heart. And I was very sore afraid, okay? So, in that regard, he came in, you know, and in fairness, Artaxerxes was not a man you were supposed to be grumpy, looking sad in front of anyway. You were looking cheerful anyway. But it seems that was his disposition, because the king recognized that this was, you know, sorrow of the heart. He saw that it wasn't just a superficial thing, but he was actually grieved in his spirit about something. And that would suggest to you that his heart was not normally in that condition, that normally he was someone of a positive outlook and positive disposition. And he was very skillful in motivating and encouraging people to the work. Look in chapter 4 and verse 14. Chapter 4, verse 14. And I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people. And this is this great speech he gave after they were threatened by Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and so on. He said, be not ye afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible. And fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. And of course the people did just that. You know, you think about it, like they were just a group of people that had returned from captivity. You know, in many ways, it almost reminds me of Moses in some ways. You know, when Pharaoh was bearing down upon them at the Red Sea, and that looked like they were going to die. You know, the sea was before them, the mountains were in front of them, and the Egyptian army was on their tail, and they couldn't take their kids over the mountains, and they certainly thought they couldn't walk through the water, and they thought they were going to die. And Moses stands there and he says, you know, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. And he makes that great stirring speech and before he petitions God as to what they're going to do. And Nehemiah does the same thing. You know, he makes this great stirring speech. And it's got, like I said earlier, it's just got to really, you know, bolstered them and made them think, you know what, he's right. And sometimes, you know, in national life, you need leaders like that, don't you? You know, even in our own national life, you know, in our own national history, the great leader for speeches was Churchill, wasn't it? And he, you know, it's funny, you know, they did a university course recently, or a research in one university, I can't remember where it was, and they assessed Churchill's speeches. And they said that, you know, according to all the rules of speech, his should have been among the least inspirational of all. And yet withal, even now, when you hear those speeches, you know, you think, boy, that is something. I can see why people signed up and said, you know what, we're not going to let these Nazis come marching over our land. Forget it. You know, we're going to fight them on the beaches, and we're going to fight them, and, you know, get them out of there. And here you were, just a little island race against this great big Nazi empire. But you know what? Just like Nehemiah, Churchill did the same thing. He stirred our people to resistance. And that's what Nehemiah did with this Churchillian type speech here in verse 14. He motivated the people. He encouraged the people to the work. Then when it was all done and dusted, they had completed the job. What? He took tremendous pleasure in it. Look in chapter 7. He saw pleasure. He saw the thing completed, and he drew pleasure from it, and he organized celebrations. And when the walls were finished, he appointed singers and he united the people in revival and celebration. Look in verse 1 of chapter 7. It says, now it came to pass when the wall was built and I had set up the doors and the porters and the singers and the Levites were appointed, that I gave my brother Hanani and Hananiah, the ruler over the palace, charge over Jerusalem. For he was a faithful man and feared God above many. Now I go to chapter 8 and verse 9. Chapter 8 and verse 9. And Nehemiah, which is the Tirshatha, and Ezra the priest, the scribe, and the Levites that taught the people, said unto the people, this day is holy unto the Lord your God. Mourn not nor weep. For all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. Then he said unto them, go your way, eat the fat and drink the sweet, and send portions unto them for whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy unto your Lord. Neither be ye sorry, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. And so he led them in this celebration of their achievement. I was thinking about that today. I was thinking when we get our building built, we have to have a big celebration. We have to have a really good, you know, get the choir in and get singers going. Hey. But we'll have this great, I think we get this building built, we'll have a great celebration. I can't wait, I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be great. A great service dedicated unto the Lord, and, you know, just have a really uplifting time. But anyway, now, as with other gifts, the administrator too can abuse or misuse his gift. Now, let me just say that this is also a means in a way of identifying your gift. You know, the other week somebody commented, you know, that they were glad they didn't have a particular gift when they saw how negative it could be and how destructive it could be. And the purpose of doing this is not to make you look bad if you have this gift, or indeed to highlight your faults, but the purpose is to show you how the gift manifests itself in a negative way. And that's important too. So what do administrators do that perhaps identify them as such, but which is not to the good of the whole? Well, first of all, they can sometimes view people as human resources rather than human beings. They need to know what people and materials are available to them, and consequently they end up seeing people as potential resources for achievement. So you know, you're just somebody who's doing a job.
Who cares if your kids are sick? We've got to get this done. You know, who cares if your tutor has called? You know, forget it. There's something more important going on here. You know, they may even sometimes use people for their own personal ambition. You know, they may see that perhaps in a particular project they can leave their mark. And so that becomes their motivation for doing something. And so they're just using people so that, you know, they can leave their mark and say, that's what I did. You know, when I was a draftsman, one of my claims to fame is that I went out onto a bare field and took a level with me and leveled the site and calculated the incline of the hill. And I went back to my drawing office and drew a linkage between two terminals of Belfast International Airport, which is very good because every time I go to the airport, I go up that linkage and I admire my work. And when I used to take my kids up there, when we were going on holiday somewhere, going someplace, I'd always say to them, hey, you know, I built this. I built this. And so it became a running joke in the family. You know, we'd get on that conveyor belt on that linkage, and the kids would go, yeah, we know, you built this. Yeah, you built this. But, you know, that's my little legacy, okay? I'm hoping it'll outlive me, and maybe my grandkids, Caden, will someday be going up there, and Kevin and Carol say, you know, your granddad built this. But anyway, sometimes administrators are that way. They want to have a legacy that they leave behind, and therefore they tend to see people as tools to that end and not as people with their own particular problems and concerns and shortcomings and so forth. Then secondly, they may show favoritism to those who have shown them the most loyalty. So administrators, they need to count on people to get things done, to get to where they need to go, and they want to know that others are standing with them. So if you're standing with an administrator on a particular project, you know, well, he's going to bring you in, perhaps, and this is a misuse of the gift. This is not something he ought to do, but he may create an inner circle of friendship, and there may be rewards to those who are deemed to be the most loyal. And so, you know, administrators really struggle with impartiality in handling people because, you know, if you're not involved, you know, if I'm doing the project, I'm the administrator, and, you know, here are these three people and four people in the front row are helping me out here, you know, well, I'm going to take them to lunch. We're going to have lunch together. We're going to come over to my house, you know, we'll talk about the project. Should have known better than to mention that in front of a Scotsman. He's lost it. So, but the rest of you, you're a waste of skin, okay? You're a waste of flesh because you're not helping me here. You're not involved. Sorry, you know, you're okay. You're filling a few seats, but, you know, I'm looking for more. And that's the attitude, okay? So administrators do struggle with this. They struggle with impartiality, and they tend to create loyal friendships and very strong relationships and partnership with people, particularly during a project. You know, it may well be when that project passes that linkage eases, you know, that connection eases somewhat. But during the work, they'll feel a very strong bond with those who are involved with them. Then their ability to delegate and supervise sometimes makes them look lazy. Like, you know, they don't want to do the work. So they're always telling you what to do. You know, you need to do this. And you know what you're going to think about an administrator? Well, why doesn't he do it? Why is he always asking other people to do it? He's always asking everybody else. You never see him doing it. You never see him at the church with a paintbrush and a son. Oh, no, he just stands there watching everybody else. All right. It's this same ability, the ability of delegation that actually enables things to be done, to get things done. And so the gift really is to see how the smaller parts fit together toward building toward the greater whole, the bigger purpose. But sometimes administrators can delegate too much work onto others. And sometimes because they view people as human resources, they don't take account perhaps of their working day. You know, somebody comes in and they've been working all day on a 12-hour shift. Administrator doesn't care, just gives you another job to, you know, get on with it. So they burn people out. That's what they do sometimes. They end up burning folks out. And they,
And, you know, you end up feeding the people on you'll see this at work. If we have to build the shell of the new building and work on the inside ourselves, watch for the administrators, because they're going to come in there and they're going to expect you to be there. They're not going to worry that you've been sick for the last 2 weeks and you've had to work a 3 12-hour shifts. They're not going to bother them. You know, there'll just be a case of, you've got to get this done. We've got to get this wall up. We've got to get this painted. We've got to get this, you know. There you go. Some inspirational speeches. But seriously, the problem is that they can burn people out. And when people get burnt out, they don't want to be involved in anything. They then back off. And they're reluctant to get involved in anything again. So administrators have to be very wary about that. They also have this particular problem that they overlook serious character flaws in valuable workers. So they don't really care if you're cheating on your wife, as long as you're helping with the project. You know, they say, you know, yeah, you think this guy should be involved in this? You know, he's cheating on his wife. Yeah, well, you know, I'm talking to him about that. You know, I'm talking about that. You know, nobody's perfect, you know. Well, that's a serious flaw there. Yeah, but we've got to get this wall built, you know. I mean, we'll talk about it when we get the wall done. He's the only bricklayer we've got. Eric's not here, so I can mention this. He's the only bricklayer we've got. Hope he doesn't listen to it on the internet. I've just accused him from front of the whole world of cheating on his wife. He's not. But anyway. But you get the picture. So they are willing to overlook serious flaws and faults in the lives of those who are helping them to attain their goal. Administrators also may close their ears to suggestions and appeals. They ignore legitimate criticisms. Sometimes this closing their ears, this ignorance of criticism, is good because it helps them not to be distracted and not be putting out every little fire that comes up. But also, it may mean that they ignore valid suggestions. And they may see, you know, anybody's suggestion as being some kind of inferred criticism or any appeal. You know, well, you know, you're just being negative. Why can they be more positive about what we're doing? And also, their ability to do this results in them actually appearing to be callous and cold toward people, you know. Because, again, the project is bigger than the people who are on it. And so they come across as hard. You know, he's hard. He won't listen. He's just doing his thing. Okay? They may also neglect to explain their ideas when they're doing something. Consequently, the workers then feel like they're being taken advantage of. People need to feel that what they're doing has a purpose and that in doing it, they are valued. Now, the administrator may well see where that person's role fits in the wider scheme of things, the greater scheme of things, but sometimes because he knows what he's doing, he doesn't really take the time to explain to others what he's doing. And so he's just pushing on, not realizing that the workers are actually losing heart, that they're not getting enough information, and they're losing heart in the project, and they feel like, you know, they're not getting anywhere and nothing's really being achieved. Now, if you look at those negatives, right, and I say this again, it's not about exposing your sin and saying what terrible people most administrators are. But rather, it's about saying, look, if you have these defects, they're simply highlighting your gift. Okay? It's not about exposing you in some way, but it's saying, look, if you have these problems, they're indicative of you possessing this particular gift. And so you should look beyond the negative and say, well, you know, I do feel that way, and I do behave that way, and I do treat people that way sometimes. But you know what? I can be more positive, and I can apply this gift positively, like Nehemiah did, and actually put it to good use in the church. Because the church needs administrators. You know, the pastor is the overseer. He's the bishop of the church. And in that regard, he has this general rulership of the whole church body. And so he sort of keeps his eye on all the irons that are in the fire. But he can't necessarily govern every iron that's in the fire. You know what I mean? He can't be everywhere at all times. You know, it would be unreasonable to suppose the pastor is going to be the one who's leading the Monday club, who's leading the Sunday school, who's leading the missions, who's leading the music ministry. He's overseeing all of those things. And yes, the people who are engaged in those things, are answerable to him in the sense that, you know, he is the pastor. But, you know, he can't be everywhere all at once. You know, he can't be preaching upstairs and also seeing what's going on down here in Sunday school. So he needs people on the ground who can take care of those things, you know. And so in that regard, this is where the administrator comes in. And we need administrators, and there's plenty of scope for them in the missions program, in the Sunday school, in the church finances, in the youth ministry, in the music ministry, in evangelism, in ladies' ministry, in men's ministry, in church events, you know, even something as simple as running a church barbecue. Sometimes you're like, oh, the pastor will do that. You know, there's only so much he can do. You know, it's a good idea somebody else says, you know what, I could organize the barbecue. I'll arrange for the barbecues to be on site, and I'll be sure that we have enough burgers for everybody, and I'll be sure we've got a couple of cooks to take control of the barbecue, and we've got some people, you know, we've got the necessary catering stuff, the knives and the forks and the plates. Somebody else can do that. It doesn't always have to be it shouldn't really be the pastor's job. But that needs administrators. And some of these things, you know, are lacking sometimes in our ministry. And we say that because often it's the same people doing multiple tasks. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. So there is plenty of scope for this gift. And if you're one of these people who thinks, you know, that you have this gift, well, you ought to come forward and say, you know, I can organize this, or I can help in this way. Let me take charge of that, and I'll be at the front of it, and we'll head that up, you know. Even like a Sunday school trip, you know, you take a bunch of, you know, take 15, 20 kids away on a Sunday school, that takes administration. You know, you've got to get letters right there to their parents. You've got to make sure they've all got their permission slips sorted. You've got to make sure they all come with lunches. Or if you're taking food with you, you got to make sure you got enough food. And you got to make sure you got a minibus. You got petrol in the bus. You got your tickets for the destination you're getting to if you're going in somewhere to a park somewhere. And all those things need administration. Now, you may have that gift. And so you've got to ask yourself, well, am I that kind of person? Do I have a methodical mind? Am I a good organizer? Can I manage people and money and resources well? Can I achieve a particular goal if it is assigned to me? If you say yes to those questions, then the chances are good. This is your gift. And you may be the man or the woman that our ministry is looking out for who could help in some area of governance in one of the smaller weeds in the bigger mechanism. We've one more gift. If you haven't discerned your spiritual gift yet, I give up. Maybe it's next week. Mercy. Mercy. That's the last of the gifts. Maybe you're a merciful person. We'll leave it there for this evening.